Republicans are looking at this from the point of view of how do they protect their own interests as part of the calculation here. And so when you're looking at the more conversation about what Donald Trump did, that's probably not helpful to Donald Trump.
Impeachment moves to the U.S. Senate where just about anything might happen. It's Friday, January 17th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also ahead, the U.S.-China trade war, not over yet, lying the U.S. into the Afghan war, and rescue dogs from around the world. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Our top story today, the U.S. Senate on Thursday took control of the impeachment case against President Donald Trump. Democrats from the House of Representatives Wednesday night carried the formal articles of impeachment over to the Senate, setting the stage for only the third trial to remove a president in American history. Just a few hours ago, the federal government's watchdog agency said the United States violated the law, the White House, I should say, violated the law when it withheld military aid to the Ukraine, which is at the heart of the impeachment case. The president Wednesday night said that the case was a, quote, hoax, even as fresh details emerged about his efforts in Ukraine. With the swearing in by Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the Senate has now transformed itself into an impeachment court, even as Republicans who control the chamber, the White House, and Democrats argue over the process. Earlier, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke with Stephen Farnsworth, political science professor at University of Mary Washington, about what comes next.
The next few days will involve working through some of the questions of procedure. What format will this impeachment process take shape? The actual arguments themselves will take place probably on Tuesday of the next week, the 21st. And from then on, you can expect probably in the range of a couple of weeks of conversation where the senators have to sit quietly and listen to the arguments for and against the impeachment. And then after that or along the way, individual motions may take place that may totally change this process from where it started.
Now, looking into the procedures that will be discussed in the next few days, one of the sticking points is about witnesses, who will be called, how that will happen. What should we expect to see in that regard?
Well, it's clear that the Democrats want witnesses, but the Republicans are in the majority in the Senate, and so unless the Democrats can convince a handful of Republicans to go along with the call for more witnesses, the conversation could be as abbreviated as just simply hearing the case by the Democratic House managers and the president's defense team, and no witnesses at all. The pressure for witnesses has been the reason why Nancy Pelosi has held off moving the articles of impeachment to the Senate until this week. But the truth is that as long as there's a majority of Republicans who say no witnesses, there will be no witnesses.
Now, why wouldn't there be witnesses? Generally, in most trials, witnesses are a key feature.
Well, the Republicans are looking at this because impeachment is more a political process than a legal one. The Republicans are looking at this from the point of view of how do they protect their own interests as part of the calculation here. And so when you're looking at the more conversation about what Donald Trump did, that's probably not helpful to Donald Trump. And so if you look at what the White House wants right now, they want a very abbreviated trial. They would love to have this as short as possible, maybe even less than the 2 weeks tentatively looking to be the plan, but certainly not witnesses. And if witnesses are called, why then it could become a free-for-all very rapidly, because there are some Republicans who say that if they're going to be witnesses, then, you know, maybe Joe Biden, the presidential candidate, his son Hunter Biden, might be part of the witness list. And so it could move very quickly away from what President Trump did do or did not do, and that could be a problem. What's clear for the Republicans, though, is that the support for Donald Trump among Republicans, it remains very high. And so any Republican who wants to side with the Democrats may face significant pushback from Republican voters and from their reelection prospects.
Now, there have been two different updates in the last day or so on the Ukraine case. The Government Accountability Office has said that there was a violation of the law in holding up the assistance to Ukraine. Will that statement potentially impact the Senate trial?
Well, it's part of the evidence that the House managers will likely include in their presentation of evidence for why Donald Trump should be removed from office. It'll be part of the conversation, but how seriously it is taken depends on the individual senators themselves as they look at the evidence and decide what matters to them and what doesn't. I think the key guide to how this story ends can be seen in public approval numbers. As long as President Trump's approval ratings are on the high side of 35, and he's never been much below 40, he should be okay. President Trump has had very, very fixed public opinion numbers, and the deep reservoir of support he has among Republicans really creates a very, very secure position, because in order for President Trump to be removed from office, two-thirds of the senators, that is close to 20 Republicans, would have to agree that he should not serve as president. And that seems very, very unlikely unless President Trump's approval rating becomes really, really negative. And then the senators might very well think that Trump is more trouble than he's worth.
Great. Thank you so much, Stephen, for coming on our show today.
Oh, sure thing. Have a good one.
Stephen Farnsworth of the University of Mary Washington speaking with our Jason Patinkin. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. The Chinese government is applauding an interim trade agreement with the U.S., but cautions the two countries must still address key concerns of mutual concern. India on Thursday asked China to avoid raising the Kashmir dispute at the United Nations Security Council, insisting it is a bilateral matter between India and Pakistan. The UN's top court says it will decide next week on whether emergency measures should be imposed on Myanmar over alleged genocide. And Pakistan announced Thursday that the Taliban is ready to reduce violence in Afghanistan. Read and watch more on VOA Asia Facebook and Twitter, plus voanews.com. And this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Harry Harris, the U.S. ambassador to South Korea, says Washington has softened its demand for how much Seoul should pay for the cost of the U.S. military presence there. But he says a gap remains and that time is of the essence. For the second consecutive year, U.S. and South Korean negotiators were unable to reach an agreement before the cost-sharing deal expired at the end of the year. Both sides hope to reach a deal that would retroactively cover the intervening weeks. VOA Seoul correspondent William Gallo attended the ambassador's meeting with foreign journalists on Thursday. A few hours ago, he spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson about the ambassador's comments.
Well, there have been six rounds of talks between the United States and South Korea on these military cost-sharing issues over the last several weeks. And the latest round ended Wednesday in D.C. with no deal. There was no breakthrough. Both sides said progress was made, but the gaps remain. They don't want to talk about details, but it's quite clear that there are still quite wide gaps. The U.S. was reportedly demanding that South Korea pay five times the amount it's currently paying to support the U.S. troop presence here. South Korea officials rejected that as sort of absurd, and it offended a lot of people, actually. Your opinion polls show that this is not a very popular thing for South Korea to give in to any demand like that.
What are the implications for these talks and for getting a deal? If there's a delay, if they don't come to an agreement soon, what does that mean for the U.S. bases? What does it mean for regional security?
Well, it is perhaps dire if you talk to certain analysts, and others say not so much, as long as they eventually reach a deal. We do have some precedent here. Last year, the two sides were unable to reach a deal until February. The deal actually expires at the end of the year, so, you know, they were able to retroactively fund things. There is a certain amount of leeway that is built into the contracts every year, so it's not like things shut down at the beginning of the year. However, there is a concern, I think, not only about if this stretches past February or March or something like that, there would start to be local Korean layoffs. Donald Trump has insisted that these negotiations take place every year rather than every 5 years, which was the case for South Korea in the past. And that just puts a lot of pressure on the alliance.
Now, just as a reminder for our audience, what is the size of the U.S. presence there, U.S. military presence?
So there are about 28,500 U.S. troops here in South Korea. Now, that number fluctuates up to about maybe 31,000 or perhaps a couple thousand beneath that. But, you know, generally there's about 28,000 troops that are here. Officially, they are here to counter North Korea, but, you know, U.S. officials would not necessarily admit this, but most analysts agree that they're also there in some sense to serve as a regional force, whether that's to deal with China or other situations like that. But, you know, there are also many troops in Japan, actually, as well, a large troop presence in Japan. And those negotiations are coming up. This would actually be 2021 where you have those cost-sharing negotiations come due. So those are sort of the next big step that could be taken here as far as U.S. Cost-sharing negotiations in the region.
All right. Now, also, the ambassador spoke about the South Korean relationship with North Korea and some proposals that the South Korean government has for that relationship. What did he have to say?
Well, South Korea over the last couple of weeks has hinted that it will resume individual tours or will attempt to resume individual tours to North Korea. This has not been accepted by North Korea, and of course they would have to agree to this. But in the past, South Korea has allowed both individual tours and group tours to South Korea. Those were ended several years ago whenever a South Korean tourist was actually killed at one of these sites by a North Korean soldier. Now, it's not clear whether this will actually happen, but if it does, if they do attempt to move through with this attempt to allow individual tours, it could violate either U.S. or United Nations sanctions on North Korea. So the ambassador, Harry Harris, today said that if South Korea does want to do this, they want to be consulted, that South Korea should run this through a working group meant to ensure that such projects do not violate U.S. or international sanctions. And it seems at this point that South Korea would honor that based on their comments of the last few weeks.
That was William Gallo, VOA's Seoul correspondent. He was speaking with VOA International Edition editor Kate Pound Dawson. Happening now in Asia, five Pakistani businessmen have been indicted in the United States, accused of operating an international network of front companies to export U.S. origin products to Pakistan for use in that country's nuclear program. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
And VOA Asia continues. The United States and China have, as we've mentioned before, signed phase one of a trade deal that may help lower tensions between the world's two largest economies. But as White House correspondent Patsy Witakuswara reports, much of the trade disputes between the two countries remain unresolved.
On Wednesday, a truce was reached in the trade war between the United States and China that began in June 2018 when the Trump administration began slapping tariffs on Chinese products.
This is an unbelievable deal for the United States, and ultimately it's a great deal for both countries, and it's going to also lead to even a more stable peace throughout the world.
President Trump signed phase one of the deal at the White House with Chinese Vice Premier Liu He, who read a letter from Chinese President Xi Jinping.
Our two countries have the ability to act on a basis of equality and mutual respect,
and work through a dialogue and consultation to properly handle and effectively resolve relevant issues.
The agreement reduces some U.S. tariffs in exchange for what the administration says would be an expansion of American agricultural and energy exports to China. The deal also includes a promise by Beijing to give more protection for American companies' intellectual property and halt the practice of forcing foreign companies to transfer technology. It remains unclear how those provisions will be enforced. As part of the deal earlier this week, the U.S. removed its designation of China as a currency manipulator. But the agreement maintains U.S. tariffs on about $360 billion of Chinese goods and the threat of additional punishment if Beijing does not live up to the terms of the deal.
But the secret annex supposedly commits China to purchases of very specific different products, different manufacturers, different agricultural goods, some services, and so forth. That annex will not be disclosed, but I suppose it will be used by the U.S. Trade Representative to see whether China is living up to the mark as they perceive the mark, as the U.S. government perceives the mark.
The deal does not address China's subsidies to state-owned companies, an issue likely to be discussed in the next phase of trade talks, which is not likely until after the U.S. November elections. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called the agreement a huge victory for the Chinese.
We've gotten very little in return when it comes to intellectual property, when it comes to people demanding joint agreements, when it comes to cyber theft, when it comes to government-subsidized businesses, the nub of our complaint.
Still, this initial agreement seems to cool tensions between the world's two largest economies, at least for now. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
And you're listening to VOA Asia. This news alert from VOA Asia. Japan has confirmed its first case of a strain of coronavirus that has killed one man and sickened 41 others in China. The health ministry says a man in his 30s who lives in Kanagawa Prefecture was hospitalized after visiting the central Chinese city of Wuhan. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a top Pentagon watchdog has told U.S. lawmakers that there was incentive for U.S. officers and military commanders to lie about the progress of America's war in Afghanistan. John Sopko, the special investigator for Afghanistan Reconstruction, testified before House lawmakers on Wednesday. His appearance comes 1 month after a bombshell report by the Washington Post claiming that officials misled the public about the war from the beginning. VOA's Jesusime Oni has more.
Spanning nearly two decades and multiple administrations, the Afghanistan war is the longest in U.S. history. Okay. Members of Congress say there are lessons to be learned.
A lack of coordination, the misuse of funds, and insufficient training for Afghans has failed to reduce violence across the country. This is completely unacceptable.
More than 24 American service members have died since the U.S. and coalition partners invaded Afghanistan in 2001. The conflict has cost Washington nearly $1 trillion. John Sopko, Inspector General of an independent government watchdog created by Congress to combat waste and abuse in the U.S. reconstruction effort in Afghanistan, told the House Foreign Affairs Committee on Wednesday a persistent incentive to lie about the progress on the ground hurt U.S. efforts in Afghanistan.
You create from the bottom up an incentive because of short time frames. You're there for 6 months, 9 months, or a year to show success. That gets reported up the chain, and before you know it, the president is talking about a success that doesn't exist. And I think that's a good issue to look at, not whether there was lying, but why.
The hearing comes 1 month after a Washington Post report that government officials misled the public about U.S. gains in Afghanistan for years and hid evidence that the war had become unwinnable. The newspaper cited Seaguard documents as evidence. But Richard Boucher, who served as Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia during the Bush administration, says there was no deliberate deception.
I think all of us tried to tell the truth in terms of what was going on in the war, the difficulties that we were facing, the difficulties of getting things done in a chaotic situation like the one in Afghanistan.
Analysts say the main objective of the war, to get rid of al-Qaeda, was met quickly. But flaws in the U.S. strategy to prevent resurgence of extremist groups slowed efforts in the region.
The idea that if we just came up with a better plan, a better strategy, a better training program, that somehow we could create in Afghanistan the kind of government that we saw as competent, capable, and therefore of capable of winning popular support and ensuring stability. I think that was partly based on an unrealistic view of the country and the people there and how it worked.
Despite notable failures, experts say a rash exit from the region could lead to deadlier outcomes.
We're at a stage where we know we want to withdraw, but we want to do it responsibly, and that requires a negotiation process.
The Trump administration has been negotiating a peace agreement with the Taliban to finally bring the war to an end. Jesus Amelny, VOA News, Washington.
And that was VOA's Jesus Amelny reporting. In the U.S., more than 3 million shelter animals are adopted every year. But if you can't find the animal you've been waiting for at your local shelter, or even nationally, you can look even further afield. Svetlana Purovskaya met with people who make these little miracles happen. Anna Rice narrates her story.
Jenny Patrick believes that if you make a wish, it is bound to come true.
We had dogs growing up, we've had pets, but I wanted something on my own. I wanted my own dog to just come home to and, you know, just, I wanted something to be responsible for, give me something to motivate me.
Patrick started to look for a dog online and stumbled upon the website of Furry Tales International, a group of volunteers run by three women, Natalia Lugavskaya-Fedorovskaya, Maya Torgeson, and Larisa Gusovsky, who made saving the millions of shelter dogs through international pet adoptions their life's work. The organization mostly works with Russia, and the more Patrick looked at the pictures of abandoned animals, the clearer she understood this was exactly what she needed to do.
I don't know how or I don't know why, but I kept going back to Hannah's profile. And, like, she just had this, like, adorable little face. And, you know, I read her profile and it, like, just being rescued from a mass shooting of stray dogs, just, it breaks your heart.
10-month-old Hannah was rescued from an alleged mass shooting of stray dogs in one of the shelters in the south of Russia. Yelena Gladkaya is a member of a Moscow dog rescue team. She took Hannah to the vet, walked with the frightened pet, fed her nutritious food, and gave her something Hannah has never encountered before, love and care. However, the woman couldn't keep Hannah. There were many other dogs that needed her. That's how Hannah's profile appeared on the website of Furry Tales International.
I saw Hannah's story, so I literally just, right then and there, I just emailed Furry Tales, and Larissa wrote me back.
After some back and forth, Patrick got in touch with Maya, who has helped find 77 Russian dogs for River Homes in the U.S. over the past 3 years.
We had the home interview set up. That Saturday, Larissa was over, who was fantastic. She and I just, we sat at this table for like an hour again, just going back and forth with our stories.
Patrick was approved, and Hannah traveled to the U.S. from Moscow. After hours on a transatlantic plane, she finally walked into a place that would be her forever home.
I was tearing up, like I was crying. I was so excited. And she comes out, and she's this petite little, like, princess already. And she just puts her little head in my hands, and I'm like, it was love at first sight.
This year marked the first holiday season Patrick and Hannah spent together, the first of many happy memories the dog and her loving owner will create over the years to come. For Svetlana Prudovskaya in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that is VOA Asia for today and for this week, a very busy news week. But fear not, we'll be back again on Monday. We hope you'll join us then as well. Until then, have a great weekend and be well.